To the FCC, or welcome back to the FCC. I think this is one of our first lunch events in the year 2015. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with the Board of Governors at the FCC and a Reuters journalist. Just before we get started, could I ask that cell phones or mobile phones are switched to silent before we get going, as we're videotaping today's session? And also, just to give you a hint of some of the events to come, our next event at the club here is on Friday afternoon, and we're gathering a bunch of writers from the Penn Association in the United States who will talk about freedom of expression, both in writing and in terms of their views of freedom of expression in Hong Kong. That's on Friday afternoon. I think it starts at 3:30 p.m. Now, on to our topic of the day. Interestingly, we penned or put together the title for the flyer, "Is the Euro Crisis Behind Us?" at the end of 2014. Well, obviously a lot has happened over Christmas and in early January, so it's quite funny to see what we entitled this talk, but I think it's also made it all the more relevant in terms of what is going to happen with the euro this year, what on earth is going on in the Eurozone, and how we might approach it. It's our pleasure today to welcome Professor Aimo Brunetti, who's here on a week-long sort of learning tour. He's based at the University of Bern in Switzerland, where he is a tenure professor. And he discusses quite a bit the outlook and perspective for Switzerland as a financial hub. But he obviously takes a keen interest in the Eurozone. And just to give you a little bit of a hint, he's a Euro bear, from what I ascertained over lunch. He will deliver a speech and we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. It's my pleasure to welcome him to Hong Kong and to the club.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation, having the possibility to speak to you on a very topical topic, as was said in the introduction. Is the euro crisis behind us? I have 20 minutes. It's, of course, a big topic, and I try just to give you a glimpse of the most important things as I see them. The content of my presentation, I will just go through some slides, start with the economic situation, and just tell you that in many of the European countries, as you certainly are aware, the economic situation is not good, especially the last years have been difficult years. Then I will come as a second point, look at what the financial markets think about the development in the Eurozone. And here is somehow a conundrum that in the financial markets, if you look at the actual numbers right now, it doesn't seem to look that dramatically. And I just want to make the point that the main reason why the financial markets are not that nervous, up to now at least, is that the ECB policies have been very, very strong. It's maybe a little bit too much to say, but it has to be a sort of a painkiller. But the pain should be there in a way, because as I come to the next conclusion is that the crisis is far from over. That many of the things that these crises at the root of this crisis have nothing to do with monetary policy. And that's, the ECB can only go so far in fighting this. Then, of course, I have to talk about Greece. Grexit, the topic of Grexit is in all mouths. I will give you some evaluation on this. And I finish with some conclusions. Now, let's start with the economic situation. There are a lot of ways to express how the economic situation is right now. I don't want to make any short-termism, but more look at the recent development. And I think an interesting way to look at it is to look what happened since the beginning of the financial crisis. And this is real GDP for Germany and for the CHIPS countries, or the PIGS, as they were called, not very fairly. These are the countries, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Ireland, Greece, that were at the heart of the euro crisis. And I think it's quite a shocking picture, because what it basically shows you is that for the last 7 years, most of these countries simply had negative growth. Well, it's one thing to have negative growth for 1 or 2 years. That's just a business cycle situation. But to have a negative growth development for such a long period of time, given that normally you have growth rates of 2 to 3% of these countries, just shows you that a lot of economic opportunities have been given up during this period. Of course, the most extreme case is the case of Greece. Greece that has had really a depression-like fall in GDP, but the other countries as well, they didn't reach pre-crisis GDP. The only exception here is Germany. It's not that Germany had enormous growth rates, absolutely not, but compared to the other countries, of course, Germany at least had some normal growth developments in the last years. Actually, there are people who say that the financial crisis had been a bad financial crisis, but at least we hadn't a second Great Depression. Because, I mean, the situation in 2007, 2008 was quite similar in many respects as in 1929 at the beginning of the Great Depression. And not least due to the reaction of monetary and fiscal policy, this catastrophe could be avoided in most countries. But in some countries, if you look at Greece, for example, Greece really had a depression or has a depression. This is a depression-like reductions of GDP. So it could be avoided depression for many countries, but some of the countries really are in depression-like situations. Of course, given this development of GDP, it's not surprising that the employment rate suffers a lot. And this is, of course, the second thing. We have shocking unemployment rates in some of the countries. The unemployment rates you see here for the same bunch of countries, the only country that has normal development is Germany, where actually unemployment rates are receding in the last years. But in the other countries, we have extremely growing unemployment rates. These are not cyclical unemployment rates anymore. These are really structural unemployment that is increasing, some countries 25%. So this is clearly, if we look at the main indicators of economic development, these are quite dire economic situation. The interesting thing is, and that's the second point I want to make, is that if you look at the financial markets that in a way are the fever measures of what happens in the real economy, we have an interesting development. This is so an indicator that we frequently use when we look at the situation. These are the yield spreads for government bonds, government bonds, which is the spreads between the government bond interest rate paid by Germany and by other countries. The other countries we look at here are Italy, green, and Spain, red. And what you see here is, at the beginning of the crisis, these spreads increased a lot, which meant that the financial markets saw a lot of more risks of not getting back their money in Italy and Spain compared to Germany. But in the last months, you clearly see that these spreads are reducing very much, and that these spreads now are near pre-crisis level, which means that at face value, the financial markets see that the risks for losing money on Italian or Spanish bonds are on the same level as before the crisis, or on similar levels as before the crisis. And this is not only the case for government bonds, this is also the case, for example, for CDS on banks, credit default swaps on banks, which is basically where you can insure yourself against a failure of a bank, where you see that the CDS premium decreased very much in the recent past. We always hear that the banking situation in the Eurozone is still problematic, but if you look at this figure, you say that financial markets tell you that the risks have clearly been reduced in the last months of having bank failures. So this is an interesting contrast between the macroeconomic situation that shows permanent problems in the GDP development, in unemployment, in government debt, and so on, and the situation on the financial markets. This is this remarkable mixture. We have depression-level economic activity in some countries. We have quite dire outlook for short and medium-term growth. There are not many forecasters that tell you that there is a boom upcoming in many of these countries. The best is stagnation or very small economic growth. The employment situation I showed you is highly disturbing. And we have very high debt levels in many of these countries, which is not surprising given the economic situation that in these constellations that the debt levels are increasing. And yet the risk perception are as during the height of the Great Moderation. The Great Moderation was the time before the crisis where many macroeconomic indicators, risk indicators, more or less showed that there was very small risks and a very smooth situation. And the risk perception already converges in this direction. The main reason for this, and that's a point I think is very important, it's important to look at financial market indicators, but it's clear that they are distorted right now. They don't really show you the real risks in some of these countries. And the main reason is the extremely aggressive monetary policy. We should be careful with terms like extremely and aggressive, but I think in this case it's really due to talk about extremely aggressive monetary policy. That's the big difference that in the Great Depression, not least was the Great Depression because monetary and fiscal policy were much too they didn't stimulate enough. During this crisis, they stimulated extremely. Let's look at conventional monetary policy. This is the European Central Bank's key interest rate. This is the short-term interest rate that they are directly controlling, where you see that we had at the beginning of the financial crisis in 2008-2009, this interest rate was slashed extremely, and in the last year, it basically came back to zero. So basically zero short-term interest rates. It's the most aggressive you can be. You cannot go below zero for a longer period of time. But not only this conventional monetary policy was very expansionary, also the unconventional monetary policy, which is monetary policy that directly tries to influence long-term interest rates by buying assets and bringing yields down for long-term assets. And here you also see that what you see here is the ECB's total balance sheet. The balance sheet of the ECB increased a lot because they bought a lot of bonds and other assets in order to increase liquidity, in order to bring down long-term interest rates. But what you also see is that in recent past, this has a little bit been reduced. And now one of the new developments was that the ECB clearly announces that it wants to bring ECB's total assets back to its record level. That's the talk about unconventional monetary policy that you see now in the Eurozone. One of the main elements will be to be more aggressive on the unconventional part. But the interesting thing, I mean, these kind of pictures you can basically show for all major central banks. It's the same for Switzerland, it's the same for the US, for Japan, extremely expansionary monetary policy. But there is one additional element in the Eurozone that is very important, and this is something that was announced but was not implemented. And this is the so-called, what I call the Draghi effect, what we could call the Draghi effect. Mario Draghi is the governor of the ECB, and during the height of the euro crisis in fall 2012, the situation was that there were clear feelings on the financial markets that Spain will no longer be able to refinance its bonds on the financial markets, and if the situation would have decreased, there would have been a danger that Spain would be forced out of the eurozone, because the interest rates on the Spanish bonds were extremely high. This was before the development I showed you before. And then Mario Draghi, in a very famous speech, said, "We will do whatever it takes to save the euro, and believe me, it will be enough." That was maybe the most famous words of a central banker in the last 20 years, and they were extremely effective. Because what he basically said, what Mario Draghi basically said, is that if a member country of the Eurozone has liquidity problems, has problems getting euro liquidity, the ECB under certain conditions stands there to give unlimited supply of liquidity to this country. So it basically says it's not possible that a country can run out of liquidity in euro. And this is important because Spain and other countries, their currency is a currency they cannot print. Usually a country has a currency that it can control. In an extreme situation, it can print liquidity, of course with negative side effects, but they can print the liquidity and give the liquidity. This is not possible for the Eurozone countries because the Eurozone monetary policy is made in Frankfurt. Of course, there is a Spanish governor in this decision committee, but he alone cannot control the money supply. And therefore, it was extremely important that the ECB reluctantly and after a long period of time said, well, we are prepared in extreme situation to give unlimited support of liquidity. And the effect was extreme. You see here, this is what I showed you before. These are the government bond yields. The government bond yields in Italy and Spain, from this moment on, from the Draghi speech on, they clearly went back to normal situation. Here you say Italy, Spain, and Germany. You see that the difference to Germany was reduced very much. So the interesting thing about the Draghi effect is that he announced a measure, but up to now, this measure, this so-called outright monetary transactions, have never been imposed. So he promised money, but he didn't have to pay the money. And frankly, we all can hope that he will never come in the situation where he has to deliver. Because this outright monetary transaction, there are a lot of details that are not clear here. So we really hope that it will stay as it is, that it has a strong effect simply by announcing the possibility without giving actually the money. Now, why do I say that the crisis is far from over? If you look at this picture, we could say, well, the worst of the crisis for Italy and Spain is over. But again, let's go back to what I said before. This is very much related to what the ECB was doing. The ECB, whatever it takes, calmed the situation, at least in the short run, because it accepted that the ECB is the lender of last resort for indebted governments. In a case where a government no longer has any possibility to get to euro liquidity, the ECB stands in and say, if you give me some collateral, I give you unlimited support of euro. This is a successful measure against liquidity risks, but liquidity risks are not the only risks that countries or companies can have, because this measure bought time, but the fundamental problems of some of these crises remained unresolved. The fundamental problem is that some of these countries have solvency risks. Solvency meaning that they simply cannot get enough money from markets or from taxes in order to pay for the expenditure. And it's very much possible that a country gets insolvent. And if a country gets insolvent, there are real credible structural reforms are necessary in order to avoid that a country gets in insolvency. Now, why do the risks for the new outbreak of the crisis remain? I'll try to explain a little bit what I mean by structural reforms here. The necessary medicine for many of the Eurozone countries, for the CHIPS countries, so to speak, for the countries that were in the crisis, they are very clear for economists. What they have to do is quite clear. They have to restore sound public finances. They simply have the problem that they spend too much given their income or given their income possibilities. And the second thing that they should do is they should do structural reforms, especially on the labor markets. The labor markets are extremely bad working in some of the European countries. If you look at unemployment rates of 20 to 25%, that's not only cyclical, that's really structural. That's because it's extremely hard you have very low incentives to hire someone in Italy or in Spain or in other countries. So these two things are clear. You should restore public finances and you should reform the labor markets. Economically, it's clear. Politically, of course, this is extremely difficult. This is extremely difficult to do this kind of reform, especially because both of these reforms in the short run make the situation worse. Because restoration of sound public finances sounds good, but what does it mean in practice? In practice, it means raise taxes and reduce government expenditures. And if you do this in the middle of a recession or even a depression, it worsens the situation. In the short run, it worsens the situation. Of course, you know that in the long run, you have the benefit that you get back your room of maneuver, but in the short run, it's recessionary. And the same is, of course, for structural reform in the labor markets. If, for example, you make it easier to fire workers, this is good in the long run because it gives incentive to hire workers in the first place, but the first effect is, of course, a negative effect because unemployment increases. So these countries are asked to do hard economic reforms in the middle of a very strong crisis without having the possibilities to have their own monetary policy. So given this mixture, it's clear that if you go too far in this direction, there is a substantial danger of a political backlash, of populism, to make it very directly. some new government just tells you, we no longer do this kind of austerity measures, we do no longer do this kind of reforms, now we go back to the original situation. And then, of course, if such a thing happens, then we have really clear solvency risks. To be very concrete, if in Greece we have a left-wing government that more or less says we stop the austerity measures, then there is a real risk that the Greek government no longer can finance its government expenditures. And the important thing is the ECB cannot do anything against this, because what the ECB can do, it can do something against monetary problems, about liquidity problems. But if a country is insolvent, it cannot be financed by the ECB. And this is the major, that's the reason why economists usually say what the ECB did, it bought time for the countries to get their house in order, but it only bought time, it's not a permanent solution that the ECB more or less takes over the public finance of a country. And of course, I tell this already for 2 or 3 years, now it's extremely topical due to Greece. I mean, Greece is exactly the case that we all feared could happen, that a populist party more or less, that there's a danger that the populist party goes in this direction. You already see this, that the spreads, these are the spreads for the Greek government bonds. They were reduced as well in the last years, but now, upcoming to the crisis, we have clear an increase in the spreads, which means that the financial markets get nervous about Greece. And the situation is, well, I have got to go back. I mean, the euro crisis erupted when Greece got big problems in 2010. And then the European countries more or less said, we help Greece in spite of having a no bailout rule, we help Greece. And the main reason why they helped Greece is that they feared a second big financial crisis in the Eurozone. And not least due to the fact that many of the government bonds of Greece were in the books of French and German banks. And there were really, if we would have a restructuring of the Greek bonds, there would have been a big danger that we have a second banking crisis in Europe. And here you see that at the beginning in 2011, a big part, these others are just government bonds that are in the books of basically of the private sector in the rest of the Eurozone economies. And that was the reason why these Greek packages were made, why Greece basically was helped. Now the situation is different. Today, that was in 2011. Today, this is the situation. Today, this big blue thing is the EFSF. This is the common fund of the Eurozone. And this common fund of the Eurozone now has the lion's shares of the government bonds. And if you take the different categories together, about 80% of the total debt in Greece is now in official hands and not in the hands of banks that could be endangered if we have a restructuring. And this means that today the risk of a restructuring of the government debt, the risk for the financial sector is clearly smaller today than it was in 2011. Or in 2010 and 2011, it would have been too big a risk to let Greece get broke. And now the situation is different. And that is very important to see if we talk about this possibility of Grexit. And that's something I want to expand a little bit on. I mean, Grexit, the exit of Greece, to put it very simple, if we could go back to a situation where Greece has its own currency, we certainly would do it. We would do it and Greece would do it. But the problem is, of course, the transition to this new situation. And many economists, including myself, the evaluation is that the transition to getting Greece out of the Eurozone is extremely dangerous. I mean, we could say we have two parties here. We have the Eurozone and we have Greece. For the rest of the Eurozone, it could be more manageable today than in 2010 of having this Grexit. Because Grexit basically means that the Greek debt more or less is cancelled. So people who are creditors to Greece lose a lot of money. This is more manageable because the difference to 2010 is that we have lower risk of contagion through the banking sector. That was what I just showed you before, that the banking sector has much smaller amounts of Greek debt having in their book. So we could have a write-off of the Greek debt without triggering a direct financial crisis. And in addition, we have now some new means to fight this contagion. The contagion meaning that a failure of Greece leads to a failure of Portugal, of Spain, and so on. And the two most important things are we have now at least the beginning of a banking union in Switzerland, in the Eurozone, and we have this fund, the European Stability Mechanism, a fund that helps countries that get in huge difficulties. So I would say for the rest of the Eurozone, the situation is better than in 2010, but it would still be very risky to let Greece out of the Eurozone, because it's a kind of a taboo that is no longer there. The taboo that today it's clear no country will ever leave the Eurozone. But if Greece leaves, of course, a lot of Portuguese or Spanish will ask themselves, well, maybe the same happens in my country. And this could trigger bank runs in these countries. This danger is smaller than it was before, but it's still there. But in my opinion, and in the opinion of many economists, and Brexit would be a catastrophe of historic proportion for Greece. And up to now, the Greek population seems to understand this, because there's a huge majority now in Greece that is still for keeping at the euro. The catastrophe would, of course, be, I want to be very short here, but the moment where it gets publicly known that Greece goes back to the drachma, every Greek will run to his bank and wants its money back, because these are good euros that will be converted into drachma, and the drachma will then be devalued. So the moment it gets known, we have a bank run of huge proportions. The bank system will be wiped out in hours. So that's the first effect that we certainly would have. The second effect then is when the drachma is there, we will have a strong depreciation of the drachma. At the same time, the government has no longer the possibility. The tax revenues will fall because we have this banking crisis. We have very small tax revenues. On the bond markets, of course, because they didn't repay their original bonds, it will be extremely difficult to get additional money on the capital market. So the only way to get money for the Greek government would be the money press. And they could, of course, print the drachma then, which means that there is a huge possibility for Greece within 1 or 2 years to be in a hyperinflation. So I would just say for Greece, it would be extremely dangerous to leave the Eurozone. And now what you at the moment observe is another kind of a game between the Greek government and the rest of the Eurozone. The rest of the Eurozone says you have to stick to austerity, you have to stick to the rules that we agreed on. If you do not do this, you no longer get any money from the European funds. And Greece, the idea could be, if we really have to leave the Eurozone, the danger is so big for the rest of the Eurozone that they will nevertheless give us money. And this is this kind of game between the Greek government and the Eurozone, and we all hope that there will not be the catastrophe that the game is uncooperative in the long run. But the Greek election end of this month will be very interesting to observe here. To conclude the summary of the current situation, the economic situation remains highly problematic. The ECB continues to do whatever it takes to ease the pain, but there are limits of what the ECB can do. The actions of the ECB lead to an artificial sense of security that resembles the pre-crisis complacency to a certain degree, because the risk, as I showed you, the financial risk indicators are now back to pre-crisis level or near pre-crisis level, which is not really aligned to the risks that are actually there. The key for improvement is not monetary policy, but it's structural reforms. So these labor market reforms and the fiscal reforms, they have to make these kind of reforms. But these structural reforms are politically very costly. And the big thing now, the big issue will be to have these kind of structural reforms, but not implement them within 1 or 2 years, because if we implement them very fastly, it will be extremely contractionary for the Greek economy, but to have a kind of a path of structural reform for the next years that is acceptable for the population of these countries. And this is the way to go, I would say. The way to go is not to have a Brexit or a splitting up of the Eurozone. That's much too risky. Going in the direction of a fiscal union could be a possibility, but I don't see any political will in any country to go in this direction. So the only possibility is to have to make the European countries more flexible in order that they can accept something like such a strict regime like the euro's regime. It's a little bit like Hong Kong has this fixed exchange rate to the dollar. One of the reasons why this works is certainly that the Hong Kong economy is very flexible, that prices and wages can adjust it's not very easy, but they can adjust in Hong Kong in a way that you never see in the Eurozone, where wages are extremely strict, you cannot change anything here. If, in a way, the Eurozone countries have to become a little bit more like Hong Kong in order to have this strict monetary regime in the longer run. And there is a danger of populist backlash. Very interesting is the recent development in Greece and what happens in the next 2 or 3 months in Greece that will be determined for what happens in the Eurozone. Thank you for your interest, and if you have questions.
Professor Brunetti, thanks so much. If you'd like to raise your hand, give us your name and organization if you like, we'll get going with questions right over here.
Thank you very much for your talk. My name's Gary Evans. Your main argument seems to be that the ECB has already done extraordinary monetary easing. I have to say I disagree with that. I mean, if you look at countries such as the UK or the US, which have seen a return to growth, their central banks have seen a much faster expansion of their balance sheets than the ECB has done. You pointed out that the ECB balance sheet has actually shrunk by €1 trillion. And also, if you look at the situation, you did mention deflation, but we have now prices in the Eurozone falling at 0.2% a year. Isn't there not a strong argument that actually the ECB should have done much more rather than just Mr. Draghi saying that he would do whatever it takes? He said that, but he hasn't actually done anything.
Yeah. Well, we can certainly argue whether they should. I mean, as you said, there is clearly now, they will go in the direction of quantitative easing, I'm convinced, and they will try to increase their balance sheet. My argument is that it's good and fine to do this, and maybe I'm not so much convinced that there is really a deflationary problem in the Eurozone, because I mean some kind of falling prices is due to the oil price development, some part of the falling prices is due to adjustments within the Eurozone that have to take place anyway. I mean some of these countries have to have falling prices and wages to get competitive again, so I don't see a overarching deflationary pressure in the Eurozone. But even if we would say, okay, there is a deflationary pressure, then I say, okay, the ECB should be more expansive, they should go in the direction of quantitative easing, but my main argument is that this will not solve the problem. It will, again, ease a little bit the situation, it will maybe prevent to having a deflationary spiral, which is a good thing to prevent, but the real reforms have to come in the fiscal and in the structural area, because otherwise what the ECB can do is it just can try by whatever means to keep demand a little bit raised, but it cannot really have this kind of supply side reaction that you need. And this is not only, I mean, you frequently hear from the IMF, from the OECD, you should do structural reform. This sounds good every time, and it's a good advice for every country. But here it's not only that it's good for its own right, it's absolutely necessary that the Eurozone functions, because the Eurozone is a very special construction with a common monetary policy, but individual fiscal policies, so that you have no possibility for the individual countries to use monetary policy to counter any cyclical developments. So the only thing that remains is fiscal policy and price and wage flexibility. Now, fiscal policy, given the fiscal situation in these countries, is not really an option. They cannot just have big stimulus programs right now. They just cannot finance it. So the only thing that remains as an adjustment mechanism is price and wage flexibility. And you only get price and wage flexibility by having structural reforms, especially on the labor market. And if you don't do it, maybe the ECB can prolong the situation, not going into an extreme depression. But in the longer run, without these kind of reforms, the Eurozone will not work. So it's good in any case, but it's especially important for a working Eurozone. I mean, most of the economists were always against the euro. They said it's the wrong order to start with monetary integration and then afterwards have fiscal and economic integration. But now the euro is here, now it's just a fact. if we believe what I say, splitting up the euro would be extremely costly, so we have to stick to the euro. Going into fiscal union is politically extremely difficult, will take decades, so the only thing that you can do is make your economies more adjustable. And that's the reason why, even if we could maybe agree that the ECB should do more, it doesn't solve the basic problem of the eurozone.
Over here, and then we'll...
Michael Gibson, Lim Advisors. In 97-98, the IMF and the World Bank came to town, or came to the region, and the condition for getting the funds was reform. Why didn't they do it in Europe, and why didn't the ECB come in with something similar?
Well, actually, they did. I mean, the situation was difficult because at the beginning of the crisis, there was a so-called no bailout rule. It's one of the important fiscal institutions in the eurozone, at the construction of the eurozone, meaning that it was not allowed to help another country in the eurozone by the rest of the eurozone. This was abolished in 2010, and then a fund, the EFSF, and later the European Stability Mechanism was built up. And this fund, more or less, is a fund where a country that has difficulties can get money from, but under conditions. And these conditions are that the country gets their fiscal house in order and do some structural reforms. In a way, the EFSF and the ESM and the Troika that is behind it works like the IMF. And the IMF is part of the game as well. They have strict austerity preconditions for a country in order that it gets money. And there is, at the moment, a big backlash in many of the affected countries, especially Greece, against these austerity measures. They say these austerity measures have been imposed to us by the Eurozone, the other Eurozone countries, the IMF and the ECB. But the mechanism that is behind this is exactly the mechanism that the IMF usually uses. You get money, but you only get the money if you have a program that improves the fiscal and structural situation. But the special situation, of course, here is that we are after a severe financial crisis, we are in the euro crisis, and the eurozone countries do not have their own monetary policy, which means that these kind of reforms are especially costly for these countries. I do not say that they shouldn't do it, but you have to be aware of the political risks. That was the main point I tried to make about Greece, that if we have populist backlash in some of these countries, it doesn't help to have very well-intentioned structural and fiscal reform programs. If you cannot implement it politically, then it's of no use. So the trick is to have imposed on these countries austerity measures that don't kill the economy. But this is very similar to what the IMF is doing when it goes to a country that has a balance of payment crisis, for example.
Tom.
Tom Holland from Gavcall Dragonomics. Professor Brunetti, you lay out your recipe for revitalizing the eurozone, restoring sound public finances, and pursuing structural reforms. However, there is an argument that these two are incompatible, that if you, as you say, if you raise taxes and cut spending, certainly raising tax rates is going to crush what demand there is. There's an argument that will actually reduce tax revenues and worsen the fiscal situation. Meanwhile, if you're pursuing structural reform and protected workers are losing their jobs, that's going to increase welfare bills and make the fiscal situation even worse. There's an argument that the only response for this is to pursue structural reform while also enacting fiscal stimulus. With the ECB sitting on yields, governments can borrow. And that the answer is actually structural reform plus fiscal expansion. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, actually, I mean, that's in a way, that's a structure of the argument that you couldn't do structural reform and fiscal reform within a very short period of time in a country that is in a recession or in a depression. And one, as you say, one possibility is, of course, the one you say, that you do the structural reform, but you cushion the structural reform with some fiscal stimulus. And economically, it would be the right thing to do. But the problem is, of course, that many of these countries start with a fiscal position that is already so bad. They have increased debt even in good times. I mean, some of these countries had deficits even in the boom before the crisis. And during the crisis, the debt to GDP ratio increased enormously, so that these countries, if the ECB does not help them directly, they would have stratospheric interest rates to get any money on the bonds. Simply, some of these countries are basically broke. And it's extremely difficult to have a fiscal expansion in a situation where you are basically broke on the fiscal side. And that's, of course, that's the whole idea of these austerity measures, cum help from the EFSF, from the IMF. What they are doing is they say these countries cannot have an expansionary fiscal policy, but we can give them some support if they do their structural reform. They replace, in a way, the fiscal expansion that these countries should do during expansion. I would say this is the equilibrium that you have now in countries like Greece. But of course, if the new Greek government says we no longer pursue these austerity measures, then there is a big danger that they are cut off from this financing from the European institutions. And then they are in a situation where they cannot finance the government finance. And then that's why this is an extremely difficult and dangerous situation. But you are, of course, right. You shouldn't do within 1 year structural reform, raising taxes and reducing government expenditures. It would just kill off the economy and is politically not tenable. But someone has to pay for this. Someone has to pay for it if you cannot pay for it. And that's the idea of usually the IMF and, in this case, these European funds. But of course, it depends on the willingness of the population and of the country to pursue these structural reforms. If this falls away, then we are in a big difficulty.
Ernst?
Ernst Herb, Finanz und Wirtschaft. Could you elaborate a little bit on the Draghi effect? You said this is like the devil when it would come. What would happen if finally this mechanism would be triggered? Would it result in ultimately in hyperinflation, or it seems to have worked in the US? I mean, quantitative easing, why should we not go ahead in Europe as well?
Well, the Draghi effect is I mean, what the situation in 2012 was that the interest rate spread for Spain increased, and it became clear that the refinancing of Spain on the normal refinancing would no longer be possible, that it would be cut off of euros. And what Draghi said is that we are prepared. I mean, before, the ECB did a lot of measures to increase liquidity. They spent basically billions to increase liquidity. But these effects were very short term, because the ECB always said, we do not want to do this because it's fiscal policy. Okay, we do it, but it's limited by amount and it's limited by time. And because the situation that was so difficult in these countries, this was not enough. And that was the reason why, in the end, Draghi said, we have to promise that under certain conditions, we give unlimited help, unlimited by amount and unlimited by time. But of course, the first thing was just words. And then what followed was a program, this so-called outright monetary transaction program, the OMT program, where basically the idea was, if a country wants to have this support, it has to be in a program of extreme long-run austerity. So it's extremely unattractive for a country to get in this OMT program, because they would have very strong conditions on what they do on the fiscal side, what they do on the structural side, in order to get this unlimited amount of money from the ECB. And I would say that's one of the reasons why no country up to now has done this. But if a country comes in the situation where it no longer can refinance itself, then it would be forced to do this. And then it will be extremely difficult for the ECB, because the ECB says, we give you unlimited amounts of money, but only if you have certain conditions, if you fulfill certain conditions. And this is a contradiction in a way. When it's unlimited, you shouldn't give a limit on saying, if you do not impose the reforms, we no longer give it to you. Which means that I think the moment where they start, the ECB starts this, it can never stop it again. Because if it stops the giving the money, then we have stratospheric interest rates for this country. This country is forced out of the Eurozone the moment the ECB stops, which means that these conditions that the ECB is imposing are not very convincing. And this means that, as you said, maybe that this will really be immense amounts of liquidity that the ECB will have to give. And we just hope that this doesn't happen. Up to now, I have to say that it was extremely successful. It just was a promise that had never been to be fulfilled. But when a situation in some of the countries worsens, it could be the moment where this OMT is really imposed. And this will be a very problematic moment for the Eurozone, that's for sure.
We have time. We'll do two quick more questions. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for this very insightful sharing. But I'm quite interested in your depiction about Greece, the Grexit. And then you have also highlighted the possibility of danger of populist backlash. So apart from Greece, which are the few members in the Eurozone that you think would be, you know the prospective, you know, members that will experience more or less the same difficulties as Greece.
Yeah.
And then the second question is that with this, you know, with the fact that of this persistent, you know, ill growth in the Eurozone, we have been seeing that, you know, given the high unemployment rate, so they are driving people all around Europe, especially to those countries where demand for labor is still relatively strong, and it's causing a lot of problems, especially in those countries, and there are complaints. And how would you assess the risk from that front? That is, how would it affect people in the less, you know, less severely affected economy, yeah, whether it will drive them to close the border eventually, and therefore another challenge to the euro system.
Yeah, maybe to your second question first. Of course, this effect is strong. I mean, I come from Switzerland. We have we are not member of the EU, but we have a free movement of labor treaty with the eurozone, which means that we had enormous net immigration in the last years, exactly due to the effect that you said. Many people from Europe are immigrating, and now we have a populist backlash in Switzerland against this. We had a vote that more or less is against this free movement of labor, and this is one of the big problems that come now in Switzerland. The other eurozone countries, I think they cannot restrict, it's impossible for them to restrict this immigration, because the free movement of labor is a basic principle of the EU. If you give up this, I think it would be impossible to continue the EU integration. That's why some of these countries will simply have this immigration. But in a way, I mean, to be a little bit more on a positive note here, if you look at the labor markets in some countries like Italy, Spain, or Greece, from a Swiss perspective, you just have to say there are enormous possibilities in these countries. The employment rate in these countries are so small that if you improve the labor markets, you have a strong potential of growth in these countries. Just look at what Germany did. Germany did some labor market reforms at the beginning of the last decade, and now they had very strong increase of employment, even during the financial crisis, which has strong growth effects. There is basically no reason why this shouldn't happen in some of the southern European countries. They have huge potential in the labor market, but the labor market regulation just prevent this potential from being realized. So if they could really go in the direction of these kind of reforms, there are huge growth prospects in these countries. And these are growth prospects that, for example, Switzerland doesn't have, because Switzerland already has a very high employment rate, or Hong Kong, for that matter. Hong Kong has already a very high employment rate. This kind of growth potential is not there. So on a positive note, there is a big growth potential there. Your second question. Yeah, of course. I don't say it's easy. It's easy to do this kind of reform. But I mean, that's one of the points of these austerity measures, of these preconditions for getting money, is to give money for this kind of reform. But this reform is in the favor of these countries. But of course, politically, it's extremely difficult. And the small steps in Italy and Spain show this. On the contagion to other countries, I would say Greece is in a special position because Greece has extremely big problems here. But if Greece would really exit, I think I would really look to Portugal, I would look to Spain, to Italy, These are the countries that could be, where there could be a danger of contagion. But it's impossible to say how strong this contagion would be.
And with that, I'm afraid we've gone past our 2 o'clock deadline. I think, Professor Brunetti, you'll be around if people have further questions. Thank you very much for an interesting talk, a reminder of things that are happening outside of the Hong Kong-China bubble. We're pleased you could be with us, and a small gift from the FCC to thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.